Hello, this is The Wire. My name is Stephen Regal from 4EB in Brisbane today. Today, the Brazilian government opens up 46,000 kilometres of the Amazon rainforest to mining. We explore the freedom of religion and the freedom to discriminate. And organised crime is costing Australia $36 billion a year.
Yeah, the reason that we're pretty keen to have that out in the public is people need to be very aware of their personal details and all the personal documentation.
All of that and more current affairs coming up shortly. Thanks for tuning in. We will have all of that coming up for you shortly. But first up, when we think about organized crime, we usually link it to drug cartels, but that's not always the case. The Australian Crime Intelligence Commission released its latest report about organized crime in the country. And according to the figures, it's costing us quite a lot. Eduardo Jordan found out more.
Organised crime involves usually two or three or more individuals who get together to commit some kind of criminal activity, usually involving the threat of violence or the use of violence. And now that model of operation could be applied to human trafficking, to drug smuggling, to computer crime, across a range of activities. But normally you need a group of people who are acting together and are prepared if necessary to use intimidation or violence.
That was director of the Center of Crime Policy and Research from Flinders University, Professor Andrew Goldsmith. The report contains recent case studies and outcomes of tackling organized crime. Acting Executive Director of Intelligence from the Australian Crime Intelligence Commission, Richard Grant, says they found an increase in the use of technology among organized crime groups.
This is the third report that we've done that's been classified to the point where we can release it to the public. But this report is really about informing the public about the state of organised crime, and there has been some differences since the last report. So what's changed in the last couple of years? I guess what we're seeing is transnational serious organised crime groups are changing, and a greater use of technology and particularly the digital infrastructure presenting as a key enabler across multiple crime types. And the impact of the availability of that technology, you start to see in a whole lot of areas, particularly around technology-enabled fraud, you know, online trading of illicit goods via the dark web, and quite clearly child sexual exploitation. And we're also seeing an uptake in new capabilities, particularly around encrypted communications.
The report identifies six enablers which contribute to organized crime. Illicit drugs are still on the top of the list, but other areas like money laundering and identity crime are high up as well. But Professor Goldsmith says these areas fluctuate from time to time.
I think we're seeing certain forms of crime expanding, the online area. I think we're seeing real growth there. It ebbs and flows a bit in some of the other areas. The patterns of drug importation and trafficking are changing more from the natural to the synthetic and so on. But there's certainly still a lot of crime organised and otherwise out there. And one thing the report shows, I think, is the area of economic crime, which is something that a lot of people aren't so familiar with or we tend not to pay attention to when we think about organised crime.
And the community is the most vulnerable.
Organised crime does flourish in communities in part because of some measure of acceptance or tolerance or indifference to what's going on. And, you know, in some parts of the world, and indeed one might argue in some parts of Australia, people participate in organised crime because it offers them economic opportunities. Now, in many places in the world, that may be seen as greed, but in some parts of the world, I think people see it as almost like a necessity. So I think, you know, we've got to see how the community responds to organised crime, partly in terms of where these people are situated. And if they've got drug problems or economic problems, then I think, you know, that's part of the solution. We've got to take the community along with us.
Mr. Grant says the Crime Intelligence Commission is working to provide support to Australian law enforcement groups.
Over the last little while, you know, we have been doing a lot of work and have identified about 70% of all either criminals or their associates are offshore. So a lot of our work more recently has been to deploy analysts offshore into key areas to gather intelligence and to build capability for the country and for the agency for intelligence feeds. If the fight and the criminals are actually offshore, then we need to take that offshore as well. So a lot of our work across the Australian law enforcement environment, and that goes to the Australian Border Force and the Australian Federal Police and ourselves, is really pushing the fight offshore. And for us, it's more about the intelligence feeds.
The report is available to the public, and it's in everyone's interest to protect themselves against organised crime.
The value of these reports is to educate the public about the level of threat and harm. And it's not to be alarmist, but it's for people to be aware of the diversity of issues happening in the community that affects their quality of life. And so this report becomes really quite critical in informing the public. And we'd hope from this it would start the dialogue in families and in businesses about what they can do to protect themselves. So we're not asking people to be alarmed, but certainly alert to the issue around organised crime. And certainly, you know, where crime has been identified, they're not getting in touch with the local law enforcement, certainly getting in touch with Crime Stoppers.
The same-sex marriage debate is stirring controversy around the country. But what will happen to anti-discrimination laws if the marriage laws are changed? Danielle Daly reports.
The line between religious freedom and preventing discrimination is finely balanced. But if the same-sex marriage postal survey leads to a change in marriage laws, this balance may need to be addressed. Professor Michael Quinlan, Dean of the Sydney School of Law at Notre Dame University, says the protections for religious freedoms in potential legislation, such as the private members bill put forward by Liberal Senator Dean Smith, are too weak.
That bill provides protection for religious ministers and for churches so that they continue to act in accordance with their particular faith position. It also provided some protections for civil celebrants who have a religious position or religious view, and perhaps a conscientious view, I can't remember, but let's say a religious view in relation to what marriage constitutes for them, so long as those people put their name on a register, so disclose their personal position in relation to marriage. It also provided some protection for religious bodies, which is quite a narrowly defined group, but it doesn't provide protections for ordinary people who may have a particularly strong or particular religious or conscientious view about what constitutes marriage. And that's what I was just about to talk about. What we've seen overseas is that some people who have that strong view have been working in the wedding industry or are providers of services or goods which may be used for weddings, and those particular people feel that their religious belief or their conscience dictates to them that marriage has a particular meaning, and they don't want to be seen to be endorsing a view of marriage which is inconsistent with their religious faith or their conscience. So where you have that sort of situation, you have a conflict between two then existing rights. So you would have the state recognised right of same-sex couples to marry in a marriage which is recognised by the state as marriage, and then you would have the religious freedom questions and freedom of conscience questions of those people who continue to strongly believe that marriage is not the way it's then defined by the state, and how you best deal with that.
But he also acknowledges that there are some protections for religious freedom in our legal system as it stands.
Oh, that's section 116, and essentially it provides, as you say, and it's been interpreted essentially to provide that the Commonwealth Government can't introduce any established religion in Australia and can't establish a religious test for employees working for the Commonwealth. They're pretty limited protections. Essentially, the reason for 116 primarily was to ensure that Australia, unlike the United Kingdom, which at that time and today does have an established religion, would not have an established religion because of the multi-faith nature of Australia as at 1901 and from Federation.
Dr. Luke Beck, a senior lecturer in law at the University of Western Sydney, doesn't think that there is any justification to exempt non-religious organisations from anti-discrimination laws.
Where you get slightly more controversial is what about ordinary commercial operators? If a person is a baker or a photographer or a florist, and has a religious objection to a same-sex couple or an interfaith couple or some other sort of couple, and should that person be allowed to have an exemption from anti-discrimination laws? And the answer in Australia at the moment is no. If you are a devout Catholic, and you, for example, and you have a religious objection to divorcees getting remarried, there's no exemption from anti-discrimination laws for commercial operators like that. So it's not clear why you would need or want a special exemption simply in the case of same-sex couples or religious objections to same-sex couples, because a religious objection to one type of marriage is surely in principle no different to a religious objection to some other type of marriage. And in the case of interfaith marriages, there's no exemption. In the case of divorcees remarrying, there's no exemption. So it's not clear why people would want an exemption that targets gay people.
The law as it stands allows religious organisations to hire and fire employees based on their beliefs of the faith. Tim Vines from Civil Liberties Australia says this effectively allows them to discriminate against people as they see fit.
Australia has some pretty broad anti-discrimination legislation. You can't discriminate against someone on the grounds of sexuality, gender, race, union membership and so on. However, there are exceptions under the anti-discrimination law which specifically exclude religious employers from the obligation to not discriminate against people on the grounds of their religious views. So, for example, Catholic schools will impose religious requirements and religious tests on their teachers, and they may even sack staff, for instance, who end up, like, leave the church, for example. They might sack staff members who come out as gay because that's considered to be against the religious ethos of the organisation. So it's quite interesting. We have anti-discrimination laws that in theory should apply to everyone, but the churches are allowed to discriminate even if they're performing a public function, like public education, for example.
Tim Vines from Civil Liberties Australia, ending that story by Danielle Daly. Well, researchers are concerned insurance companies can unfairly exclude Australians from coverage based on genetic testing results. The Australian Genetic Non-Discrimination Working Group says insurers have a conflict of interest in both writing the rules around the use of genetic testing and enforcing them. Currently, holders of life insurance are required to hand over genetic testing results if they are requested by their insurer. Legal advisor in public health genomics at Monash University, Jane Tiller, says the law currently allows insurance companies to discriminate against people based on their test results.
Life insurance companies are able to ask for your genetic test results when you make an application for a new policy or an updated policy. And under the law at the moment, they're allowed to discriminate against any applicant on the basis of those results. So that means they can increase premium or they can deny coverage if they see that there's a risk. Now, the issue that we have with that is that there's really very little regulation over how they can use those results, what kind of evidence needs to be behind the decisions that they make or the underwriting decisions that we make in that sense, and that can really affect people's ability to access insurance.
Ms. Tiller says it's hard to track down information on how often this happens or how many cases there are.
Anecdotally, you'll hear stories from people who've said that things like this have happened to them, but because there aren't really any clear and transparent ways of them being able to access reviews of this kind of decision and appeals mechanisms, it's really difficult for us to find the people that it's happened to. So although there are some examples, it's quite difficult to document them in a really rigorous way. But the concern for us is that even if it's not happening every time, the fear of it happening is causing people to decide not to have testing, which in a lot of cases could save their lives.
Insurers are governed by the Financial Services Council, which both represents and regulates the industry. Its rules ban members from asking applicants to undergo genetic tests in support of an insurance application. They are, however, allowed to ask applicants for their results if they have undergone testing elsewhere. Ms. Tiller says it's unclear how life insurance factor these results into their calculations around premiums.
Life insurance companies are allowed to ask for your genetic test results, and that includes anything from a highly reliable clinical genetic test all the way to results that come from research or results that come from direct-to-consumer genetic tests that you might order online. Now, the reliability of that genetic information and the interpretation of it varies drastically And so if an insurer is accessing information that comes from one of those tests that hasn't come from an accredited laboratory or hasn't been interpreted according to validated guidelines, we're not even sure of the accuracy of the data they're getting, let alone how they then apply that into their underwriting calculation.
But policy manager of life insurance at the Financial Services Council, Jesse Krencevic, says there is information publicly available for consumers to understand.
There is an education process which we've been collaborating on with geneticists for a number of years. We've developed some fact sheets around life insurance products and genetic testing in Australia. And this is to help inform consumers on how genetic tests and family history is handled by life insurance industry. So there are some key fact sheets that are out there that make it clear to the consumer how we do handle genetic tests. And look, and we do encourage the consumers to go to the Centre of Genetics Education to have a look at those fact sheets.
Mr. Krencevic says the Financial Services Council takes on the advice of geneticists in making their policies.
We engage with the geneticists in the development of our testing standards, and those have been reviewed by geneticists, and we've taken on their considerations and also implemented many of their considerations into our standards. So look, I think that's encouraging, you know, for the industry to collaborate with geneticists, in which is a very difficult field of science, is important.
Yep, and no one is disputing that. What I'm saying is that, just going back to what has been said, is that if you were an agency of government, that would be made public. And so the advice that you had gotten in making these policies would be made public. It would be much more transparent. So isn't there value in that, is basically what I'm saying. And it, clearly some people would like this to be more open and transparent. Isn't there value in that?
Yeah, look, the difference between, a legislative process and consultation and self-regulation is that self-regulation is aspirational. So we can take those standards beyond what could potentially be in legislation, and also it brings the industry beyond where it currently stands. So consultations are quite slow, and if we're looking at the field of genetics, it's evolving quite quickly. So, you know, having the ability to self-regulate and change to make changes to standards to evolve as the science evolves as well is quite important.
So that begs the question, would the council ever consider allowing their members to ask applicants to undergo genetic testing as a precondition of service?
Look, as I said, this is a fast-evolving field of science, and look, we don't know where that's going to land in the future. So I feel uncomfortable ruling things out. But one thing I will say is that we continue to work with consumers and geneticists to make sure that the policy is right. So we can only adapt that to future advances. And I feel really uncomfortable predicting where the science of genetics will land. I'm not a geneticist myself, so I couldn't possibly comment.
Jesse Krencevic from the Financial Services Council ending that story.
After a hard day out in the paddock, I like to catch up with a wire. Find out what's going on around this big country.
The Wire, bringing you the stories from all around Australia.
The federal government of Brazil has abolished a rainforest reserve the size of Denmark, prompting an outcry from environmentalists around the world. The government of Michel Temer justified the policy on the need to boost economic development in Brazil. Professor Bill Lawrence from James Cook University studies forest environments around the world. He says these areas are among the most important in the world in terms of biodiversity.
Well, the areas that are protected in the Amazon are instrumental in terms of slowing deforestation. Of course, they've got the highest biological diversity than just about any place on the planet, and tremendously important environmental values. The Amazon has a huge effect on the global climate via all the carbon that it stores, but also all the water vapor that it puts up into the atmosphere, which is very important in terms of driving the generation of clouds and rainfall, and also reflecting a lot of heat back into space, and mitigating floods and a whole variety of other reasons. So trying to protect the Amazon. It's probably the most environmentally ecosystem on the planet from a human perspective in terms of having large impacts on our global climate.
So there have been fears expressed that as the government has allowed for resource companies to come in and conduct exploration in the in that area that has been, the protections have been removed from, that that won't be the end, that there will be other groups that come into that space and also seek to exploit the area. Do you think those fears are well-founded?
Yes, I do, actually. There's been a large trend across the Amazon and also in other parts of the world where protected areas are coming under pressures. There's even a name for it, PADDD, which stands for Protected Area Downsizing, Degrading, and Degazettement, or something like that. But basically, it's become such a common phenomenon that people have given it an acronym now. So we see this happening quite a lot, actually, in places like the Amazon and also Africa and other areas, where basically oil or mineral and oil and gas exploration rights are being given out inside the hearts of protected areas. And in some cases, large areas have been carved away or protected areas have been cut in two for these kinds of projects. And obviously, it's an attack on the national protected area system. And everything we know about biodiversity and about environmental conservation suggests that these things are a bad idea. The current park that's being opened up, as I understand it, it's about 1 million hectares in area. This is also happening. It's happening under a very conservative presidential administration within Brazil of Michel Temer. And he has developed a very anti-environmental agenda. And people didn't really know where he was going to be coming in. And again, anyone interested in conservation or the environment has been deeply disappointed in the series of attacks that he's taking. One might also mention that he's under very serious investigation for allegations of corruption. And in fact, they've commenced impeachment proceedings against him.
The stated rationale behind removing these protections in the Amazon is just quite simply economic development. Now, is the country really in such a bad state that this will have an effect on that?
It's actually a lot more complicated than that. Brazil is indisputably in bad economic shape, and they've had a whole series of reasons for that, but opening up one of the Amazon protected areas isn't going to even be a drop in the ocean towards the kinds of economic problems that they have, which stem much more towards financial mismanagement, by gross corruption, by large-scale political payoffs. For instance, just to go back to Brazil, the president is only able to remain in office by virtue of the fact that he's giving away incredibly generous multiple billions of dollars of handouts and incentives and other kinds of quasi-legal payoffs to essentially his environmental allies in Congress, which are the so-called ruralist party. So it's really the ruralists that have as an agenda a very strong agenda of development. And they have a whole, for example, another thing that they've supported is a so-called land thieves law, which basically, in the Amazon, there's been vast areas of land that have been illegally cleared and settled and squatted on or illegally logged, and people just go in, and they want to allow, in fact, the president, Tim Temer, has in fact already supported, and he's signed now, making it legal for an individual to go in after the fact, after you've cleared up to 2,500 hectares, which is like 5,000 football fields in area. And in fact, you can go in and then your brother and your sister and your aunt and your uncle, you can all put in separate claims, each for your own 5,000 football fields of deforestation, and each get titled to that. And
Professor Bill Lawrence from James Cook University ending that story. That's The Wire for today. Great to have you with us wherever you are in Australia. We're a co-production between Radio Adelaide, Sydney's 2SER, and 4EB in Brisbane, and we're produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can hear us weekday same time on your local community radio station. Check us out on thewire.org.au, where you can listen back to anything that you heard on today's show. Check us out on Twitter, The Wire Radio, all one word, and Facebook, The Wire Independent Current Affairs on Community Radio. Today's program came to you from 4EB in Brisbane. My name is Stephen Regal. See you next time on The Wire.
It's not just about people in barrels, so shut up.
What the hell?
Plenty of interesting banter to offer up right here on 2SER.
Good last if life's shrunken head.